Good, may I welcome you very warmly to the Moorgate Talks, adding to Ian's welcome. And as Ian said, last week we were looking at the question, is God there? Is God there? And I argued last week that God has made himself known through the complexity and the beauty of this world, and especially through Jesus Christ, his Son, who came to earth and was resurrected from the dead. You might say this, you might say, well, I can accept that God is there, but actually from what I know of the Christian God, I'm not sure whether I like the sound of him. Does God really send people to hell? Does God really only accept Christians? If that's what God's like, I don't want to have anything to do with him. It's an understandable objection, I think. The idea of fairness is hardwired into us from an early age, isn't it? Any of us who have anything to do with small children will have heard that plaintive cry, won't we? How does it go? It's not fair. If God's not fair, well, it's understandable, isn't it, if we want to have nothing to do with him. More than that, it calls into question whether he's God at all. Something inside of us, I think, tells us that if there is a God, he will be fair. Maybe we don't know where that instinct comes from, but it's a powerful one. If God isn't fair, he's no God at all. The opening line of our Bible passage today deals with God's fairness head on. Let's look down at it again. Peter says, I now realize how true it is that God does not show favoritism, but accepts from every nation the one who fears him and does what is right. That's a sentiment I expect we could all agree with. These are the standards we expect of God, aren't they? A plain statement about a fair-minded God. God does not show favoritism, but accepts from every nation the one who fears him and does what is right. The Bible insists that God is fair. And perhaps as we hear that statement, we find it massively reassuring. You see, most of us will think that that places us in the clear. We tell ourselves that we basically do what is right. Or at least, we're confident in our ability to clean up our act when the time comes so that we'll be acceptable to God. Is that right? The trouble is, though, that God's standards are just a bit higher. The Apostle Peter here, who was one of Jesus' closest followers, Peter's speaking to a man named Cornelius, who was pretty much as good as people get. Let me read to you how Cornelius was introduced a little bit earlier in the story. At Caesarea, there was a man named Cornelius, a centurion in what was known as the Italian regiment. He and all his family were devout and God-fearing. He gave generously to those in need and prayed to God regularly. Cornelius was devout and God-fearing. He gave generously. He prayed regularly. If God is going to accept anyone, he would accept Cornelius, it would seem. But it wasn't that clear cut. Cornelius needed to be sent the Apostle Peter to explain the message of Jesus Christ before he was really accepted by God. Even for this upstanding citizen, his good and worthy life was not enough on itself to make him acceptable to God. He needed something else. And the same is true for us. I don't know everyone who's here today. I'm sure among the lawyers and the bankers that we've got here, there are some very upstanding members of society. I expect there are people here, for example, who have raised large sums of money for charity through incredible feats of endurance. I expect some of us pray regularly to a God or gods who they're not sure that they know, but they want to please. I expect there are people who faithfully support church events, even if they wouldn't quite place themselves among the committed. Surely a fair God would accept people like these. But you, like Cornelius, need something else. You see, our good intentions are really put to the test when we're confronted with Jesus Christ. Our reaction to Jesus truly demonstrates whether we're those who fear God and do what is right, or whether we're those who look impressive but actually reject and oppose God when he comes to earth as a man. Even those who say they follow God can end up doing what is very wrong. That's starkly revealed by what Peter says next in his speech at Cornelius' house. Let's pick up again from verse 34, beginning of the passage. Peter says, "I now realize how true it is that God does not show favoritism, but accepts from every nation the one who fears him and does what is right. You know the message God sent to the people of Israel, announcing the good news of peace through Jesus Christ, who is Lord of all. You know that what has happened throughout the province of Judea, beginning in Galilee after the baptism that John preached, that's John the Baptist, how God anointed Jesus of Nazareth with the Holy Spirit and power, and how he went around doing good and healing all who were under the power of the devil, because God was with him. We are witnesses of everything he did in the country of the Jews and in Jerusalem. They killed him by hanging him on a cross." Hang on a second, that's a painfully jarring note, isn't it? They killed him by hanging him on a cross. Jesus came to bring the good news of peace. He was anointed by God with power. He went about doing good and healing. And what was his reward? They killed him. Before we can answer the question of whether God is fair, we need to ask whether people are fair. When we're confronted with Jesus Christ, how do we respond? The response of the Israelites in the first century was that they killed Jesus, the man who had gone around doing such transparent good. You see, people are not fair. People are unfair. Before we start to tell ourselves that we would have behaved better than the Israelites, just remember who we're dealing with. The Israelites were the people who seemed most likely, humanly speaking, to respond favourably to Jesus Christ. They had been promised a powerful saving king many hundreds of years before he came. There are dozens of specific promises in the Old Testament part of the Bible which were fulfilled precisely in Jesus Christ. Circumstances he had no human control over. Things like where he was born and what he was called. The people of Israel had had previews of God's saving power through Jesus Christ as they were rescued from slavery and as they were given prototypes of him through men like the King David. And of course they had known and heard and talked with and seen the miracles of Jesus himself when he walked the earth. Peter states the major events of Jesus' life as undisputed, well-known facts to that generation who had lived through them. If anyone was going to respond rightly to Jesus, it would be the Israelites, you would think. And yet they killed him. They killed him because he challenged the status quo. They killed him because he revealed that they weren't as acceptable to God as they thought they were. He showed them that they were hypocrites. He called them whited sepulchres. In other words, that they were pure and unblemished on the outside, but dark and morbidly unclean on the inside. And that offended them. It made them angry and jealous. If someone insists that they're good enough for God, well, they find it outrageous if someone tells them that they're not. And what about us? What about us? Our good works for charity, our prayers to unknown gods, our support for established religion, well, all of it is worthless if when we're confronted with God in the form of Jesus Christ, we reject him and kill him. Of course, we can't kill Jesus physically ourselves today. But do we kill him by social rejection? Refusing to associate with him? Do we damn him with faint praise, acknowledging him as a good teacher, but refusing to have him as Lord and Saviour? Do we trivialise him, telling ourselves and anyone else who will listen that we've no need for Jesus as long as we do good? Make no mistake, if those reactions are yours, you would have been with the mob baying for Jesus' blood if you had lived in Jerusalem in the first century. Is that fair? Was the way that Jesus was treated by the Israelites fair? No, of course it wasn't. Jesus did everything good towards them, and he was met by brutal torture and assassination. Maybe we can feel the pain and injustice of Jesus' treatment, even in a very small way. Maybe you've had that experience of doing everything you can for someone, making great sacrifices to help someone, and then they throw it back in your face. They turn against you and make out that you were selfish all along. Have you had an experience like that? Can you even feel a flicker of the pain that that causes? The outrage, the injustice, the wounds that cries out for vindication. People are unfair. And so actually the fairness of God demands that he acts in justice to punish those who have acted so harshly towards him, who have pretended to be upstanding and honourable, and yet who have rejected and opposed Jesus Christ, his son. People are unfair. But thankfully, mercifully for us, God is more than fair. God is more than fair. You see, when his son was unjustly and brutally murdered by a people he had only done good towards, God didn't instantly react in revenge, wiping them out and bringing punishment that they deserved. Let's read what happened from the middle of verse 39 there, towards the beginning of the second paragraph. They killed him by hanging him on a cross, but God raised him from the dead on the third day and caused him to be seen. He was not seen by all the people, but by witnesses whom God had already chosen, by us who ate and drank with him after he rose from the dead. He commanded us to preach to the people and to testify that he is the one whom God appointed as judge of the living and the dead. All the prophets testify about him, that everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins through his name. God raised Jesus from the dead on the third day, just as Jesus himself had promised many times during his life. And he established witnesses who didn't just see visions of Jesus from a distance, but who met with him, sat down and had conversations with him, who ate with him, proving to them that he had really been raised from the dead. And he sent those people back to warn of God's coming judgment through Jesus Christ, to plead with people to repent of their sins, to hold out the offer of forgiveness through his name. God's fairness is shown in the judgment to come. Fairness demands that there is a judgment, doesn't it? We can all see in the world around us the injustices, even if we can't see it in our own lives. We can see that justice demands a day of reckoning, a day of righting of wrongs. The fact that there is a day of judgment coming reflects God's goodness, God's fairness. And of course, Jesus will judge everyone the same, the living and the dead, with no favouritism. But God is more than fair. He also holds out the offer of full and free forgiveness for all the ways that we fail to do what is right. Ultimately, for our rejection of his son, Jesus Christ. That forgiveness is possible because Jesus' death wasn't in vain. Jesus' death was the ultimate sign of mankind's rebellion against a good God. But at the very same time, it was the ultimate sign of God's goodness itself. You see, Jesus' death was fully the responsibility of those that nailed him to the cross to be tortured to death. And at the same time, it was always intended by God, who planned Jesus to be a sacrifice who was punished in the place of sinners. Jesus was the only man who always did what is right. And yet when he went to the cross, he switched places with those who deserved to be punished for their sins, their rejection of God. And so Jesus died a sinner's death on the cross, while those of us who are true sinners can go free. We were given a glimpse of that substitution, one life for another, just a few weeks ago, actually, when the Costa Concordia cruise ship ran aground. Passenger Nicole Savelle was saved by her husband giving her his life jacket. "I owe my life to him," she said. "I jumped off, and the last thing I heard him say was, 'I'll be fine.' Then I never saw him again." Like the passengers of the Costa Concordia, we are desperately in need of life jackets. And like the passengers of that cruise ship, it would be utterly foolish and arrogant to reject a life jacket from someone who had gone to such lengths to provide it. God is more than fair. He doesn't simply judge all people impartially, but he responds to astonishingly unfair people by providing a way for our forgiveness at great personal cost. Do you see that God is more than fair? By contrast, our own claim to God's fairness is actually special pleading. When we tell God that, of course, when we tell ourselves that, of course, I'm good enough for God, well, we barely convince ourselves, let alone convince God. He sees through our external good works, our upstanding public persona, our patronizing religion. He sees what we're truly like deep down, and that's revealed through our basic attitude to Jesus Christ, his Son. We discover whether we truly fear God and do what is right, and whether we accept the life jacket that's offered through the costly sacrifice of God the Son. Now that message will be offensive to the self-righteous person, I know. The self-righteous person will say, how dare you? I'm okay, I don't need saving, I'm better than many other people. But the message that God is more than fair will be an absolute lifesaver for any of us who feel unworthy of God. Maybe there will be some of us today who know that deep down we've stuffed up, that God has no reason to be pleased with us. Maybe you feel that you've got no chance of being accepted by God, precisely because you know that he must be fair, and fairness means that you wouldn't be accepted by him. The good news is that Jesus came for people exactly like you. Not for those who feel sure that any reasonable God would actually be quite impressed with their good works, but for those who are willing to admit that we fail to meet God's standards of perfection. Is that you? Because today's message is great news for you and any like you. That last verse says that all the prophets testify about Jesus, that everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins through his name. Believing in Jesus simply means trusting him to deliver on his promises and receiving the life jacket of forgiveness which he holds out for us. Well, there are four possible responses, I think, to the things that we've been hearing today, and they're summarised there on the sheet that you were given by A, B, C, D. I'll describe what they stand for. You might just want to put a circle around the one that which applies to you. At one end, A stands for absolutely. I agree with everything you've said. And I know there are many committed Christians among us this lunchtime, and thank you very much for coming. At the other end, D stands for don't believe a word of it. And again, if that's you, thank you for coming. We're going to have a question time in a few minutes' time. I'd love you to jot down any killer questions that you've got for me, because I'd love to hear how you can explain away some pretty strong evidence about what's been said and done in history. I'd love to talk to you further. In between those two polar responses are the B's and C's. C stands for considering it. I need to think about this some more. If that's you, do join us again for our regular talks here each Wednesday lunchtime. You can listen to past talks for free on the website. You might also want to sign up for the Christianity Explored course, which is a DVD and discussion-based course over 7 lunchtimes, setting out the basics of what Christians believe and why. It's a great place to ask questions and to wrestle with what you should believe for yourself. And just on the front of the handout there, there's a little box where you can jot down your details, tick the box for Christianity Explored, and we'll let you know when the next course is due to start. B stands for beginning today, I want to accept the life jacket Jesus is offering me through his death. There's lots I still don't understand, but I accept Jesus' sacrifice and his rule over my life, and I really want to do what's right by trusting him. If that's you, if there are any B's here among us this lunchtime, I'd love to join you to join me in echoing the words of a prayer that I'm about to pray. I'll say each line and then I'll pause so that just silently to yourself, you can echo it in your own mind. I'd love you to join us in this prayer. Let's just bow our heads and I'll pray particularly for the bees among us. Dear God, I'm sorry that I don't live a life that's good enough for you. Thank you for sending Jesus to die in my place. I gratefully accept his offer of forgiveness. Please teach me to live a new life with Jesus as my Lord.